Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From Backpage, I'm Martin Gregg, and welcome to another episode of Between the Lines. This is my conversation with tennis commentator and host of the tennis podcast, David Law, about the new Andy Murray documentary on Amazon Prime, Resurfacing. Even if you've watched some of the other documentaries on Amazon Prime, I think this one stands apart. And that's why I wanted to get the story behind it from David, who's been shadowing Andy's career from the beginning. As I mentioned, David is the host of one of my favourite shows, the tennis podcast, and they are currently doing their annual Kickstarter, which I'll give you more information on at the end of the show. Enjoy. So David, I want to speak about Resurfacing because it was a documentary that really kind of confounded my expectations, I guess. The access was amazing, but I think that struck me more than anything was Murray's openness, which I found to be absolutely astonishing in parts. Now, I've not been near the tennis circuit in 10, 15 years, so I thought I would really like to get your perspective on it. Did this documentary reveal sides to Murray that you'd never seen before?
I think it probably more filled in some blanks for us, that the people that follow him all the time, because we've seen his journey from being this really awkward teenager to somebody who's actually become very open with us for the most part. I mean, there are moments, and you tend to find, particularly when you go to Grand Slams, when the spotlight is on him, I find that we call it puts his game face on, and he's much less open at those particular points, and he's almost a little bit adversarial and grumpy with us. But for the most part, if you get him outside of those really tense times, you see he's a pretty open book particularly with those that follow him regularly. But what I would say with this documentary, what they did is they didn't necessarily go out intending to create a documentary that would end up like this. They couldn't possibly have foreseen the story that he went on, the journey that he went on, in terms of thinking his career was completely finished, to coming back and having this surgery which nobody had ever had before and played professional tennis again with, and ended up winning the doubles at Queens. You know, that's where the arc that it goes on. But the woman that shot it with him is kind of part of the family. She's the fiance of his brother-in-law, of his wife's brother. And I saw her come to the Queen's Club, where I'm media director, a couple of years in a row. And we opened the doors, really, because we knew that it's something that he wanted to have filmed. So we let her follow him around the player lounge and to the practice courts and sit in the support team seats, places that cameras can't normally go. And you could tell that he was all for this, and he was just very comfortable and open about it. But at the time, I think it was just meant to sort of give a bit of an insight into what his life is like. And then as it gathered pace, they started to realize, actually, that this is just an incredible story that is unfolding. So they kept shooting. And I think with Murray, he has a really curious mind. He really is interested in finding out everything, how it works. And you know, if you find yourself in his company, he spends as much time asking you questions as you asking him questions. And so I feel that he's just gradually become a lot more comfortable with just being an open book. I think he's happier just to say it how it is, whether it upsets people in terms of what he's commenting on or whether he's revealing stuff about himself. Yeah, he if he's going to do something, he does tend to do it properly.
The thing that struck me was the total ownership that he took of the documentary. When I first was aware that the documentary was happening. It was when he was on the red carpet, like maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago in London, and he was talking about it. And this didn't seem to me at the time like this was something that his agent said, oh, you know, this will be a good idea for you to do this Amazon documentary. He was saying, you know, this is my thing and I hope people really enjoy it. And then when I watched it and I thought, wow, he's recording footage from under his duvet at night where he's admitting his career is over. He records these quite profound voice memos where he talks about the Dunblane massacre, he talks about his parents' divorce, you know, Jamie leaving home, these three huge kind of moments in his life. Amazon film at his home, I mean, a very, very private individual, but you see his wife and his children, him playing with them. At some point, obviously, he just decided to go all in this documentary because it was only meant to be up to the point of his first hip operation, which didn't work. But then when the story continued, there must have been a point where he said, right, this is all in, and I'm going to follow this story through to its conclusion and let the cameras film it.
But again, I think a big part of that is the fact that this was filmed by Olivia Cappuccino, who's somebody he's got to know well, and he's clearly ended up trusting her. And whilst it feels like a very immersive documentary, it was always only her. I never saw anybody else. I never saw another camera come. So she has, I think I read somewhere that she'd filmed 4,500 hours of footage and she was just around. So I think she ended up becoming kind of just part of the furniture to some degree. But the thread that runs through it is her just constantly asking him, why do you care so much about tennis? Why are you so into it? And I think it was a slight self-discovery for him to try to work that out himself, because he's obviously buried an awful lot in his past and tried to just put it away so that he can cope with life day to day. And what you saw in the documentary is him deciding or just discovering himself that he there was more to it than just the play in the sport, and there was a reason why he was the way he is, and he finds that out right in front of us. What I loved about it was the rawness of it, the fact that it was just him under a duvet with his selfie video or his voice notes, and the power of something that's not massively produced like that. It was just, it gave it a visceral quality that I really appreciated. And yes, I mean, I think the most interesting bit to me in terms of the access that we got was the day that he more or less announced his retirement at that press conference in Australia, which was a press conference I attended. And we saw a video of him agonizing about whether to go ahead and actually tell us all this stuff, or and his indecisiveness, trying to work out, is this it? Am I finished? I don't know. My hip doesn't actually feel too bad this morning. Sure, you know, so he was going through all this stuff. And I think that was a real insight into the individual. I've seen snippets of his indecision over the years like that. And that's not to criticize him. That's just, he can see the possibilities. He can see the alternatives, and sometimes he doesn't know which path to take. So he tends to leave things to the absolute last minute and then make his decision.
Yeah, that was really interesting for me as well, that level of indecision. And there's actually a moment where Kim, his wife, kind of makes a joke about it, and she's like, oh, Andy's changed his mind again. I've always thought of him as a very decisive guy. And obviously you've picked up on, you know, elements of that indecision, but to see it to that extent, actually throughout the documentary, it's a kind of mini theme, isn't it? This you know, toing and froing in his personality. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think then when push comes to shove, once he's made his decision, he goes all in, to use your word from earlier on. And once he's decided he's going to do an interview or have the cameras rolling, you know, he's not looking to finesse things. I mean, the fact that he went to that premiere of the documentary, and that was the first time he'd ever seen it all, the license that he gave her to film it and the producers to edit it in their way, there was no looking over the shoulder and saying, oh, I don't like that a bit. And, you know, I've heard other people do these sort of things and micromanage them. And he doesn't do that. Mm-hmm. He gives you what he is. Once he's made his decision to go for it, he just goes for it. I mean, if you let him down, or if he feels let down, you wouldn't get another opportunity. But that seems to be his way of operating, is all or nothing.
When I first heard that it was his brother-in-law's fiancée that was directing it, I must say I was slightly sceptical. I've had slight issues with some of Amazon's output. I mean, stuff like the Man City documentary was very interesting in parts, but in other ways you kind of feel like it is a bit of an in-house job. And I was kind of worried that this would be that, but I've got to be honest, David. I mean, time and time again, I kept being astonished at different aspects of it that kind of overrode any concerns I had about it. What do you think? Do you think that Cappuccini walked that line between obviously having that level of familiarity but keeping that kind of journalistic objectivity?
Yeah, I do, really. I mean, I think that she just shot what she shot, and I think there is a, from my experience with her, there is a journalistic edge to her, in that she, you could see how much she wanted to get good stuff, and the way you or I might in an interview we might conduct. I didn't think there was much going on in terms of shielding at all. I didn't, that was my sense. And look, you might get an interviewee who holds something back themselves, but from her standpoint, I didn't think it was compromised at all, really. I think that one or two people have said it was a little too long, and it's a shame that the Antwerp victory that he ended up having in the singles wasn't in there, which I can see that point, certainly. But no, I think it's a documentary to be trusted, certainly. When I'm watching it, I don't feel that wasn't in the back of my mind that she was part of the family or anything like that. I really enjoyed sort of, yeah, filling in the blanks for me, and then for people, I spoke to my mum about it, and she watched it, and, you know, she's not in the tennis world at all, and she was absolutely captivated by the whole story. She didn't realise all these ups and downs had happened. You know, she'd heard, yes, he'd had a hip injury, and yes, he'd come back, and that was about it. So, no, I think it's an honest portrayal, and I wouldn't have any concerns about how legitimate it is.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That familiarity thing I found really interesting, because there were times where you just thought he is speaking as if the camera's not there. That's the thing that kind of broke through for me. I thought, well, if you manage to pull that off, then nothing else matters, really, because you're seeing the real Andy Murray.
Yeah, and I think that over the years, that's what has resonated with people from him. There are a lot of people that didn't like Andy Murray early on because of one or two things he said, and maybe the way they were portrayed. And yeah, I mean, look, some of the things he does, I don't particularly like on court, the way he barks at his team. And he's embarrassed by those things when he sees them back. I think he's made one or two errors over the years, but he's authentic, really. And I think people like that. I know other players and other sporting stars that are so much more conscious of how they come across, and they do micromanage it. And I think that people can often see through that. And he's definitely managed to resonate with people, because what you see is what you get.
It ends on his first singles match back at Cincinnati in July 2019. But for me, and you've mentioned it there, Antwerp would probably have been a more fitting place, surely, because that's where he beats Stan in the final, and in a classic kind of Andy Murray dogfight match. Did you not feel that, like, that would have been a kind of more appropriate full stop to the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, look, yeah, I think I don't know the complete reasons why they didn't do that. But I think it's probably a timing issue of putting this thing to bed and saying, okay, we've finished the filming now. And I think that there must have been a thought process that how is it ever going to get any better than Andy Murray getting on the doubles court and winning it with Feliciano Lopez? How is it going to get any better than that? And also, oh, look, we managed to get him back out on court in singles again. I really don't think that they could possibly have seen Antwerp and a victory over Stan Wawrinka. I don't think they could have seen that coming. So I think that they probably ended up just pulling the plug a bit too soon in hindsight, you know, and I think in hindsight they would absolutely have loved to have had that in, is my guess. Mm-hmm. But you know what it's like with these things. If you're going to keep filming, you could... I mean, what if it didn't happen and you said, okay, I'll tell you what, we want to wait until he has one more singles moment. And what if it doesn't come? And what if he then retires? You know, it is difficult to make those sort of calls. But yeah, look, in hindsight, I think that would have been the absolute perfect ending.
I mean, just to finish up, David, we were talking a little bit before about Murray's mastery of the media, which is something that really interests me. I covered Andy's first couple of Wimbledons, and at that point, you know, he didn't know how to handle the press, and that's not a judgment because he was just 18 or 19 years old, but it was a very adversarial relationship. But at some point along the way, the penny seems to have dropped. You know, he understands how to play the game, I guess, and you know, as we know, it is a game in some sense. But since that point, he's never really looked back since he's worked it out. I'm interested in, you know, why and how that change came about. Do you think, did somebody break it down for him about this is how you do it? Did he work it out for himself, or did success kind of mellow him?
I think it's a combo. I think, you know, I remember seeing his first interview after he won the US Open Juniors in 2004, and he gave this one-on-one interview with a colleague of mine at BBC Radio, Jonathan Overend, and Jonathan asked him, you know, what's your favourite Grand Slam? Is it Wimbledon? And he said, no, I like the US Open. They treat you like adults, you know. Wimbledon, they don't really respect you. You're like a junior. You're treated like juniors, and whereas at the US Open they treat you like one of the players, you know, and all this. And I mean, these were really spiky comments straight off the bat, almost uninvited. And it was just box office to listen to. But you thought, crikey, he's going to put some backs up, this guy, the way he talks. And I watched his development then. He had an Australian Open where he lost early on, and he kind of had a pop at the media straight afterwards, saying, you know, you're always saying I need to win everything, and it's just not realistic, and I don't think you're being fair, and all this sort of stuff. And I mean, I think he just didn't get it, really. And he did speak to one or two of the journalists to say, well, why do you say this sort of stuff, X, Y, and Z about me? And they explained it to him. And look, there were some, I would say, irresponsible moments of reporting as well. For instance, his comments about the England football team, which were made in jest, and they were made up to be serious, and that worked against him for years. There have been others like that, where I definitely think we in the media have been responsible for a misrepresentation of him, which have caused problems. And for a while, he certainly pulled his own head in, and he just decided he wasn't going to be open at all. And then people thought he was grumpy, and he didn't say anything. And he was just being safe because he thought, well, when I do say stuff, you know, it gets taken up and blown up in a way that's used against me. So there was a working out period there. I remember the first iteration of a kind of semi-autobiography. Yeah. I mean, bearing in mind this was only about 3 years into his career, and it was titled Hitting Back.
That's right. Yeah.
And we were like, well, what are you hitting back against, you know? And it was just him it just felt like this rant against everybody he felt that was criticizing him. And it just wasn't the way to go, I didn't think at all. I think then he changed management companies, and he's been with, for the last 10 years, a group in 77, the one he ended up naming this group after his 77 years since the Fred Perry Wimbledon triumph, between that and his own. And they're sort of former PR experts themselves, and I feel as though they kind of helped him along with it. And I don't feel like he's been spun to anybody, but they just have helped him to understand who he is and put him in situations and interviews with people that would be able to get him across to people. But I think the biggest thing is that Murray has figured it out himself. And that is, I am going to be myself, but I'm going to be careful with one or two things. There's some things I know that could get inflamed and cause a problem, but I'm going to say it how it is and not be afraid of that. And that has come out, his stances on sexism and things like that. I mean, have certainly for women's tennis, for instance, you speak to the vast majority of female tennis players and they absolutely revere Andy Murray. They love him because he will speak out on their behalf and he will stick up for them. And I just think that's the thing. He hasn't tried to copy. I think I sometimes feel a bit sorry for Novak Djokovic because I feel as though he's just got it wrong in as much as he's this incredible champion, but he's kind of copied the way Roger Federer does things in terms of his public profile. And you're always going to end up being compared to that, whereas Murray has just gone his own way and has won far, far less. And I think he's probably just appreciated on the whole. I mean, Djokovic has got a huge fan base of his own, but the neutral fan, I think, really appreciates Andy Murray in a way that maybe they don't as much with Djokovic, because they don't feel they know Djokovic. They can't relate to him. Murray just sort of lets you have it. This is me, and I'm quite comfortable presenting it to you.
Just finally, I mean, obviously, we talked about the end of the documentary and where it could possibly have ended in Antwerp, but can you give us like a resume of where Murray is at and his comeback at the moment? I mean, how do you see the next 12, 24 months unfolding for Andy Murray? Is it a steady climb back up the rankings? Is it a kind of straight graph, or is there going to be more twists and turns ahead?
Do you know, I find it so hard to confidently predict that, because the way he's going, I think the tennis level he has, and if he could stay injury-free, I could see him becoming a force and being a top 20 player again and getting to the second week of Grand Slams. Whether he can go to the quarterfinals and semifinals is another matter, because there are so many good players around. The concerns I would have are the physical ones, because you've got the hip. Now, fortunately, he says he still has no pain from it, which is brilliant. But there are other he's had a sore elbow a few weeks ago. He had to pull out after his first match in the Davis Cup because of a groin issue. And the truth is, I don't think he knows how the rest of his body is going to hold up to the rigors of full-time tennis again. I feel some players they get to a point where the body just can't really handle that anymore. And maybe his is around the corner as well. I asked him a few weeks ago what he would consider to be success 1 year from now. And he said, to be healthy, to be injury-free. If I could have had a year without any health issues, that would be good enough for me. And I think if he can have that, I could see him being a top 20 player this time next year and having had one or two big moments that we will always remember again from the Grand Slams, whether it's beating a top player or getting to a quarterfinal or a semifinal. I think those things are possible. But I also think there is a chance that something may go physically that he ends up just thinking, do you know what? I don't want to come back from this one. I don't want to go through all that rehab again. I've had enough now. And I think the difference is, for the next big injury, if he has one like that, I think he would be okay with that. Whereas the big shock to the system for him was with the hip problem. It came out of nowhere. He was world number one. He just won Wimbledon again. He just won the O2. He'd won everything. And he felt like this was going to be his next 3 or 4 years to contend for the biggest titles in the world with Djokovic, Nadal and Federer. And he had that ripped away from him. And I think mentally that was incredibly tough for him. I think that sent him tail spinning. He's got through that now. And the documentary tells you that story. I think he could handle life after tennis now, but when that's going to be, no idea.
Thanks to David for agreeing to this interview. Check him out on Twitter at @DavidLawTennis and check out the tennis podcast at Tennis Podcast. They are running a Kickstarter campaign to fund the new season of the show, and I'd urge you to check it out by searching for the Tennis Podcast on Kickstarter, and it's also on a pinned tweet at the top of their Twitter feed. Finally, check out the entire archive of Between the Lines, and if you've enjoyed this, please leave a review, tell a friend, spread the word.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.